Group meeting, Sunday, 8th February, 1987. Last month, we came to the point where we saw that in the state of communion, the discursive mind is silent. When out of communion, the talking mind never stops its incessant chatter. The discursive mind, by discursive mind I always mean the activity of the brain. The brain is always chattering away. It never stops chattering. It does so even in our sleep. And sometimes we wake up and remember our dreams, as we call them. That's all due to the chatter of the brain. And it chatters like that because what has happened during the day hasn't been fully observed and worked out completely. Whatever is not worked out completely remains as arrears to be done in the brain, and the brain mulls over all that. Those are our dreams. When that activity of the brain in sleep is over, we experience profound slumber. The brain has stopped talking, and it is in that state that we are actually in communion with the totality, with the whole universe, but not having realized holistic consciousness, we are unconscious of that state of unity. It's a sort of an unknowing knowing. It's a knowing of the unity of the universe, which includes us, but we are unaware of it. We still remain unaware. This chatter of the brain is mainly verbal. When not verbal, it consists of a succession of sense impressions, visual, auditory, tactile, gustatory, olfactory, whatever the sensations may be. It also includes the restless confusion of memories and indulgence in anticipation. If you watch your thought process throughout the day, that is, in Buddhist terms, we talk of samasati, perfect mindfulness, which means watching the thought process that goes on in the brain from moment to moment without stopping. You will find that when one is free from any special activity which needs concentrated attention, memories will keep coming up all the time. Memories of the past. Oh, if only so and so hadn't done that, I wouldn't have had all this bother and whatnot. Whatnot, you see. Things like that. Hates, loves, fulfilled desires, unfulfilled desires. There's an immense stock of all these memories in the brain. They come up and are a nuisance, really. Or it's either that, or we spend our time daydreaming, anticipating, oh, if I could only have another £1,000 a week, I can have a holiday on the Costa del Sol, and so forth. Although the Costa del Sol nowadays is not very much in favor. And so on. So you see, this play of memories and anticipations. and it's a whirlpool which goes round and round the consciousness of the isolated, separative self. And it is always concerned with one's own pleasure, success, and the fulfillment of desire or ambition. The whole world is like that. I should think even those who are very nearly the holy ones also have to be on their guard in this matter. And therefore, we can see the importance of that seventh step in the Noble Eightfold Way, which the Buddha called Samma Sati, complete mindfulness. But I don't think sufficient explanation has been given as regards the nature of that mindfulness. We have to be mindful without taking sides for or against whatsoever is what is called good or evil. Now, this always raises lots of questions. One, even a man like Gandhi hadn't the perception, hadn't sufficient perception to realize that when he said, "We hate the evil, but not the evil doer," that is a mistaken statement. You associate evil with the evil doer. No evil doer, and there is no evil, obviously. So to say, "Oh, I don't hate the evil doer, but I hate the evil," there is always the association at the back of our minds, deep down in the brain, there is the association with so and so. I remember one of my own awful experiences during the war years when we lived in Cardiff in my father-in-law's house. There was a little woodland at the back of the garden, and after that terrible winter when we had that ice storm, great branches of the big trees in that woodland fell off, crashing down with the weight of the ice. And of course, it was helpful in one way. We had wood fires in those days, coal and wood fires, you see. And I was rather skillful in my youth. I was pretty young then, in wielding an axe. And each time I wielded that axe and split the wood, I had Hitler in mind. No, it's of course one laughs at it now, looking back on it. But it's a terrible thing, really. Because it poisons the psyche, my own psyche. Then one day I had a dream. This was after the war was over. Hitler was dead, of course. I had a dream that I was in a restaurant, and the waiter serving me, very gently, kindly, charmingly, was no other than Adolf Hitler. And I remember thinking in the dream, "Good heavens, is this the fellow that I wanted to smash up with that axe of mine? How absurd, how ridiculous." You see, it's like that. Samma Sati has tremendous implications. I think during the first 10 years of our meetings here between 1962 and 72, I constantly talked of samasati. But of course, I couldn't formulate it in this way, that it implies that one should observe whatsoever is taking place without taking sides for or against. Then the question arises, well, how do you get rid of the evil? You can't destroy evil. Especially one's own evil. What can you do? You can watch it. You can recognize this is evil. This is a hateful thing. A terrible thing. How many times people wish, I wish so and so were dead. You see. That's an evil thought, isn't it? An evil feeling. Alright, you can't destroy the evil, you watch it. Watch it carefully, don't fight against it. Don't be an enemy to it. But keep that person in mind and slowly, slowly understand it. This is how it is. Now I can't do anything about what happened 20, 30, 50, 60, I can remember back to 70 years ago easily. You see? Easily. One doesn't hate and say, if only that chap, that awful devil or man or woman or whoever it is hadn't done so and so, I wouldn't have to suffer this, that and the other, you see. No, understand it quietly. And in that understanding, the revenge feeling, the hate feeling that has been suppressed within one will dissolve away. And that psychical energy will get transformed into the energy of pure compassion. We are involved in all the evil in the world. We are involved in all the good in the world. Looking at the good that way, without taking sides for or against it, you enhance the good. Because we generate a psychical energy which goes out from us all the time. Really, the religious teachings of the world as regards purification are so profound that it takes real insight, real genius to penetrate into the full meaning of these things. Well, let's get on now. Restless confusion of memories and indulgence in anticipations. All this chatter centers around the I, the ego self, in our ordinary waking and dream states. In profound slumber, self-consciousness is perforce cut off. It is a temporary death, the death which holds within itself the mystery of regeneration, not death the destroyer. When I was writing this, I was writing this somewhere around 1965 and 6, those were the years. Death the destroyer means where the individual self is concerned. It means that I myself, if I die, have left unpurified, uncompleted, that which ought to have been purified and completed. That way death is the destroyer, as far as oneself is concerned. But death in itself is not a destroyer, it's a regenerator. Here we are restored to communion. But this is an unknowing communion, a communion without attentiveness. When, not asleep bodily, the discursive mind stops talking and attentiveness is at its intensest, we are wholly awake and silent. When the brain stops talking, really stops talking, we are silent. This is the communion which is the transcendental realization of truth, the infinite, call it God if you like, which you experience as an egoless being. Because I say egoless because when the brain stops talking, the I consciousness, the I am I consciousness, is completely devoid of any separativeness. You know that you are you, but you don't feel any separation, any isolation with respect to the not-self, to the rest of the world. This state is the one source which is the living root of all religion and religious teachings. Here, all the teachers are at one. Out of this unitary truth, there grows and proliferate the different, there grow and proliferate the different religions. They proliferate for the very simple reason that the teacher lives at a particular time in history, in a particular culture, with a particular background, circumstance, education, culture, and all the rest of it. Therefore, there are differences in the presentation of this realization. The presentations are different. After the transcendent experiencing, back in ordinary consciousness, that is, the consciousness which is wholly mixed up, dependent upon the functioning of the senses and the logical activity of the brain using language as its tool. That's ordinary consciousness. Back in ordinary consciousness, those who realized were aware that no discourse spoken aloud as audible speech or spoken silently as thought could contain or could express unerringly this experiencing. You can't describe the experience. In the human world, there are those rare cases when man and wife experience complete and absolute unity in marital intercourse. It is a transcendent experience. That is a fact. There is nothing to spoil that. Ordinarily, marital intercourse is associated with dust and ashes afterwards because repetition of the happy experience is desired so much but cannot be fulfilled. You see? But in this sense of unity, the separative self-consciousness has completely vanished. There is the actual realization of the us consciousness. It's not you and I, the beloved and the lover. It is us, just one. Their whole being was saturated with bliss, And of course, you can never describe the experience. You can talk about it up to a point. I can tell you lots of things about it. But whatever I say is not the actual reality. It's beyond words, beyond thought. It cannot be formulated. Their whole being was saturated with bliss, with peace, with love, with enlightenment, with deathlessness. And they saw with clear sight that the words and conceptions associated with man's escapist longings, named bliss or love or immortality, were not the real which they had experienced, or rather which the real had manifested through their experiencing. Wisely they affirmed that the real was not this, not that. Neti, neti, said Yajnavalkya. You remember? In the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. It cannot be spoken about, it cannot be thought of, it is achintya, unthinkable. You see? Because words and thoughts are instruments of limited manifestation. And this is an experiencing which is really in the context of the infinite eternal. It is not a limited manifestation. There is an absoluteness about it. It is transcendent. Well, the wise ones knew this. But since the love call of their disciples, who hungered and thirsted, could not be denied, many an affirmation of the great religions of the past took the form that they did. The sons, the worthy ones, ready for the esoteric teaching, understood and profited. The sons does not mean the sons of the flesh. I've explained this before, those of you who have been coming for a long time now. When any disciple or disciples of the teacher reach a certain stage of development where they are able to be at one in consciousness with the teacher, then they are called the sons of the teacher. These are the words of the Buddha. It's on page 188. I made a mistake yesterday when I said 180. On page 188, of the Udana. Monks, I am a Brahmin, one to ask a favor of, ever clean-handed, wearing my last body, incomparable physician and surgeon. He goes on, ye are my own true sons, born of my mouth, born of Dhamma, religion, created by Dhamma, my spiritual heirs, not carnal heirs. Now you find the same thing in the Rig Veda, book 10, hymn 90, forgotten the verse, where it is said that the perfected Holy One is born of the mouth of Brahma, and he is known as the Brahma Putra. Putra is son, the son of Brahma. You see? So sons means that the perfected Holy One was himself present to correct and help them. Thus for them there was no intrusion by the sorrow of time, of psychological and not chronological time, upon the bliss of eternity. When one's consciousness is utterly free of the isolated, separative I am I consciousness, then you are actually functioning in the context of eternity. But the moment that consciousness steps down or is brought down by external impressions or from memories or thought processes arising from within oneself, then the time process comes into play, and time is always associated with sorrow as well as pleasure. Pleasure, pain, joy, sorrow always go together. But there were many others who were in thrall to the sorrow of time, driven though they were by the pain of being out of communion. They could not shake free from the shackling demands of intellect, from the craving for a verbal construct that would lay down a logical doctrine and point to a goal to be reached by a mortal person in time. So, alas, devoid of the realized being's wisdom and skill and inspiring presence, the lesser teachers spoke learnedly. Beware of the learned man. Only where learning is the complete servant of wisdom, learning is valuable. God, ideas like this came out. God or the transcendent was the other than oneself. Union with the transcendent or fellowship with God was the goal at the end of a way. There was a method, a discipline, a practice of holy living which constituted the way. This is true only to a very limited extent. For this reason, every single human being is absolutely unique. You have to find your way. Transcendence is not short of infinite variety. Every person is unique, and whilst the general principles, the type of the process applies to large numbers of people, for each person the way is his or her own way, because you are constituted that way, psychophysically constituted that way. There is no one else in the world like you. You see? So, your discovery of the way to holistic consciousness is your particular method of discovery. Watch yourself, know thyself, nothese auton, as the Greeks said. And Atmanam Atmana Pashya, as said in the Rig Veda, long before the good old Greeks said nothese auton. Oh, more than 1,000 years before them. I forget the exact reference. Atmanam Atmana Pashya, it comes. The words symbolizing the goal, such as Brahman or God or truth or immortality or peace or bliss were taken in their conceptual meanings by their followers. That is, as the opposite of the other component of a duality, namely the devil or falsity or death or turmoil or sorrow, thus sowing the seeds of the errors and confusions bedeviling all theologies. Nevertheless, the pure heart of religion throbs through the bruised body of Scripture. It is for each man to listen, to watch, to understand, and to be in communion. That completes the first five chapters, part one of the book. 61 pages. We've taken 2 whole years over it. And there are 388 pages more. I'm sorry. 389 minus 61. 328 pages more.